Hey, whether you enjoy listening to Breaking Down Collapse or Building Up Resilience, I think you'll also really enjoy our bonus content on Patreon.
Yeah, Kellen and I take 20 minutes each week to talk about the news that's happening all around us and Collapse as it plays out. We like to have a little fun with it, but also make sure that you're aware of what's going on in the world of Collapse.
We look forward to having you join us there. The link to join us on Patreon is in the episode description.
Okay, so yesterday's episode, we focused on carbon storage and how it's the amount of Earth in which we can store carbon turns out to be much less than previously estimated. Today's episode goes along a similar vein. Because look, as we look forward and we say, hey, climate change is a real issue, and there's a certain, you know, there are certain numbers of things that we can do to mitigate it. Obviously, the biggest of those things is reduce the amount that we are emitting. And then there are things like carbon sinks, in which we can say, well, we are emitting, but at least we have this ability to sequester that carbon so that it doesn't end up in the atmosphere increasing warming. So those are kind of the two main areas. Now, again, yesterday we focused on sequestration. Today, I actually have two different articles that we're going to read through. These are scholarly research papers, just like yesterday's, and they actually touch on both of those topics, sequestration and emissions. And we're going to see how, through these articles, we're learning that, yet again, there is reason to readjust the understanding that we have, especially from a scientific consensus, on the potential for reduction in emissions, specifically in methane in this case, and an increase in sequestration from forestation and reforestation. So let's start with the forestation. This is in science.org, and the article is titled "Land Availability and Policy Commitments Limit Global Climate Mitigation from Forestation." So I'm not going to go as into detail in this article as I did yesterday, just because we have two articles we're doing, and yesterday the episode went a little bit longer than normal. But essentially, I'm going to read the summary, and then we'll go through the abstract a little bit. The editor's summary says, "Cutting emissions is necessary to curb climate change, but storing carbon in forest biomass and soils can also contribute to climate mitigation. Estimating the potential increase in forest carbon is hindered by limited data on soil carbon sequestration rates and unrealistic assumptions about the land available for forestation. Wang et al. Addressed these issues by synthesizing soil data and considering potential effects of forestation on warming, water quality, and biodiversity to produce a more realistic estimate. Less than 40 petagrams of carbon by 2050 from reforestation and afforestation, which is much lower than previous estimates. Considering only the land that has been pledged for forestation in existing policy commitments further reduces the estimate." So essentially, they did a bunch of analysis of available land for forestation and reforestation. And what did they find? 40 petagrams worth of carbon can be sequestered by 2050. So over the next 25 years, petagrams, one petagram is the same as one gigaton, and we emit about 40 gigatons annually of CO2. So they are saying that by the year 2050, we should be able to sequester an additional 1 year's worth of our current rate of emissions. Now, again, over the next 25 years, so that means 1/25 or 4% of emissions can be sequestered by further reforestation efforts. Now, there's a bunch of assumptions and things that are being made here, and they are saying that the 40 petagrams worth or 40 gigatons worth is at the high end if all of our assumptions were to be optimistic. If all of the land that was available to us realistically to reforest, then we could sequester that low amount of carbon. The realistic number, they said, that last sentence said, considering only the land that has been pledged for forestation and existing policy commitments further reduces the estimate. That drops it down to an estimate of about 12.5 petagrams or 12.5 gigatons. So about one quarter of 1 year's worth of emissions from this source. And really, when it comes to carbon sequestration, right, we have a certain number of carbon sinks. We've got the oceans, which are a massive one, and which we'll touch on in a different episode in the future. We've got soil, which in this case, they are talking about the soil from forestation and how it's one of the largest soil sinks. And so, yeah, that's the focus of this one today. And then we have man-made sinks, which is what we focused on yesterday through carbon storage. So, yeah, again, this is a good lengthy scholarly article. I recommend you come through and read it if you're interested in it in more detail. But essentially they're saying, yeah, this the actual amount of soil that we expect is capable through forestation is much lower than previously estimated. Much of this land that they're saying, you know, is available for this, the majority of it is in Brazil and the Amazon. Some of it is in Europe and some of it is in the US. And when we talk about reforestation, we're talking about making areas that used to be forest, that are no longer forest, back into forest again, right? And there's a reason that it's no longer forest. And so the actual act of having to, you know, for Brazil to say we're going to reforest the Amazon, well, as we know, the Amazon is losing more and more forest at record rates every year. The effort that Brazil puts forth fluctuates pretty dramatically based on who the president is and what their priorities are and such. But we're not gaining forest in the Amazon. And as a matter of fact, due to climate change and savannification, there's a risk that the Amazon forest flips from rainforest to savanna, in which case we would lose it all as a forest. Now that will take time. That's not something that's going to flip rapidly. I mean, it will be rapid on geological scales, but talking between now and 2050, the amount of carbon, again, that we're talking about sequestering is relatively negligible, and it depends on a large number of countries making commitments and carrying out those commitments. When it comes to all sorts of climate goals and mitigation, yeah, hundreds, you know, 140 countries make pledges and promises to what they're going to do. But in reality, the actual number of countries that meet those pledges is very small. And in turn, other countries, specifically developing countries, not only don't meet those pledges, but they are the main source of emission growth. And that's where we go to the next article. This is in nature.com. Again, this is another scholarly research paper titled Global Methane Footprints, Growth and Drivers from 1990 to 2023. This paper explores 164 countries and what has caused either a growth or reduction in methane emissions in each of those countries. In the abstract of this paper, it identifies that 30% of global warming comes from methane. If you want to learn more or go deeper into methane, I refer you back to the episode that Kellen and I did on methane. In that, we discuss that the what was it called? The GWP, I believe, which is the global warming potential of methane, is 80 times higher than CO2, right? But over a shorter period of time, over the first 20 years. So methane is interesting because if you can cut methane, you can cut our total number of amount, right, of CO2 in the atmosphere more rapidly. That said, we are not cutting methane. Methane is still growing, and it's growing at an increasing rate. Since 1990, CO2 emissions have grown by about 1.8% every year, while methane emissions have only grown by 1.2% per year. However, the paper points out that the rate is actually increasing. You know, in the first, 15 years or so, from 1990 to around 2003 to 2005. Well, looking at the paper here, it actually says to 2002, and there was an annual growth rate of 0.8%. Since 2002, global emissions increase at a faster rate of 2% per year. So while it averages out to just 1.2% since 1990, the rate of growth of methane is increasing. And that has an adverse effect. You know, I just mentioned if we can cut it, then it will have a more rapid relief on climate change because it can remove it from the atmosphere faster. However, if we're increasing the rate at which we're emitting methane, it will have an inverse effect and more rapidly affect, at least in the short term, over 20 years or so, the amount of global warming. One interesting thing here is that it notes that developed countries are actually getting better when it comes to, they call it the emission coefficient. But basically they're saying that in developed countries, that coefficient is improving, where in developed countries, it's getting much worse. Part of the reason, you might think, oh, well, it's just because developed countries are just in general becoming more efficient, or maybe they are decreasing emissions, following through with their pledges. But actually a large part of this is just outsourcing. Developed countries are outsourcing production to developing countries like China and India and different places throughout Asia and Africa. And so by moving that production from one place to another, it's still indirectly, you know, coming from developed countries as well. But those developing countries, in addition to just, you know, increasing production from outsourced labor and production, they themselves are just growing rapidly. And that growth often comes from the use of less efficient fossil fuel because it's cheaper. Yes, developed countries might have more money to put into more sustainable methods, whereas developing countries don't have access to that. Nor do they have access to the same sort of regulations and checks to make sure that there's no methane leaks and all that type of stuff. Okay, so what is the point of these research articles? Why am I bringing them up, right? There's three of them now between today and yesterday, and they're all basically saying the same thing, which is, hey, as a scientific community, previously we've had this consensus that there are things that we can do to mitigate climate change, and those things are X, Y, Z. But now as we do further research, as we reassess and look into things more clearly, we can see that by like an order of magnitude or more, we were wrong. And we're seeing this not just in this type of research paper along the lines of mitigation, but we're also seeing it in the reverse when it comes to things like emissions projections into the future, impacts of climate change, these models and studies that are done on how quickly we're going to hit, you know, 1.5 and 2 degrees and 3 degrees and 5 degrees Celsius, and the impacts that that's going to have on humanity. All of those things are changing as well. Maybe not increasing by an order of magnitude, but even just saying, oh, hey, the impacts of this thing are going to be double what we expected, right? Or, you know, turns out we're going to hit 2 degrees Celsius 40, 60, 80, 100 years earlier than anticipated. Or, hey, climate sensitivity is actually a much higher degree of warming than we had thought previously. Part of the big issue that I see when it comes to scientific research, right, and the reticence for scientists to come out and be able to say, hey, like things are much worse than we previously thought. Over the last 5 years of this podcast, it's been apparent that that reticence exists and is there, right? We've always said things are moving faster than expected. We'll read, you know, a research paper in the past, and it just seems like this feels overly optimistic, but this is what the scientists are saying. So I guess like this is what we have to sort of report on and say is the belief in the moment, right? And it feels weird and it feels like conspiratorial or whatever to be like, the scientists are being too conservative. It is worse than what they're saying, right? But now we're starting to see that they're coming out and saying, hey, so it turns out things are worse than what we said before. And who knows when that will stop? To what degree do they reassess their models and find that the future is worse and coming at us faster than what they had previously estimated. And then what does that do to the mainstream view on this? Do people actually pay attention to that? The damage may have been done, right? When for years and years and years now, every climate change article, it has, you know, all these terrible things that could happen because of climate change. But then the very end of the article says something optimistic, like, with mitigation efforts, scientists believe that climate change can, you know, we can mitigate this and we're going to be fine as long as we can keep it below 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2100. Well, guys, I got news for you. We've already passed 1.5 degrees Celsius, you know, for now multiple years, and we're headed towards two. Not just headed towards it, but we're barreling towards it. So, yeah, is there any way to correct that? Is there any way to alert people to the reality of how serious it is and the drastic measures that must be taken to avoid the very worst? I fear that it may be too late for that, but we can do the best that we can, I suppose, and we'll see how the media treats this in the coming years. All right, thanks for being here. See you tomorrow. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.